So welcome to the course which will deal with review of classical physics. And basically I have two modest goals. So first, to review classical mechanics. So I'm sure that you all know what classical mechanics is about. But because it's a sort of cornerstone of modern physics, both the classical field theory and the classical mechanics, I really want to review these things and get you into the speed. And then of course, you will start from here in relativity course, and you will start from here in the quantum theory course, and so on. So this is very important that we are all on the same page. But at the same time, I will use an opportunity to actually discuss some more advanced topics, which you may be familiar with, but maybe some of you are not, which are the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Who has seen Hamilton-Jacobi theory? Okay, approximately half. That's great. So for half of you, this will be new. Then I will explain what I mean by integrability in classical mechanics. And basically, integrability means that I can truly integrate the equations of motion. And you may be surprised how strict conditions there are for this to happen. And so integrable systems are very rare, but they are at the same time very important. And so, for example, a very nice integrable system is the Kepler problem, where you study the two-body motion. And then you can study more realistic motions by perturbing around this integrable system. And then you can get the real results. Also, I would like to discuss constraints, but that will take only probably half an hour. After that, I want to go to the classical field theory, and I will start with the motion of the string. So where you can actually nicely see how you can go from classical mechanics to classical field theory. But then I will mainly concentrate on Maxwell theory, which is also the cornerstone of modern field theories. So first of all, we will see that once we have Maxwell theory, we are inevitably led to special relativity. Although in practice, it took people almost 50 years to go from Maxwell to special relativity, but you'll see that it's almost immediate. But it's also a gauge theory. So every modern theory is a gauge theory. So we have some gauge freedom in Maxwell theory. But it also has some nice symmetries, of course, because it's relativistic. It has the Lorentz symmetry, but it has also the conformal symmetry, at least in four dimensions. And so this leads you to interesting topics like conformal field theories and ADS, EFT, and stuff like that. Okay, so that's the plan. So I gave you the syllabus, which is more detailed. So I will start with Lagrangian mechanics, then go to Hamiltonian mechanics and discuss these more advanced topics. And then we go to string and Maxwell and whatever. So I don't know if you looked at your PSI wiki page. So I uploaded a study text there, so you can follow that study text. I'll more or less try to follow it. I hope there are not many mistakes. If you find some mistakes, please let me know. I'll be happy to correct them. But also, there are these classic books. So I really like Landau and Lifshitz, the first volume, which is it's about 100 pages long, but it has everything in it. It's just like great selection of topics, and it goes quite deep as well. So interestingly, not always the arguments of Landau are correct, but the results are. And the approach is very physical. It's very intuitive and it's very nice. So I will actually try to follow this method. So not everything I will tell you is actually correct, but the results should be okay. If you want correct treatment, go to Arnold, which is like very mathematical, very thick book, Mathematical Methods of Classical Mechanics. It uses the approach of symplectic geometry and contact geometry. We will not have time to touch on those, but if you were interested, I can give you maybe two lectures later on, maybe after Christmas, when you are equipped with differential geometry and stuff like that. So I could tell you what symplectic geometry is. Okay, so then there's Classical Mechanics by Goldstein. And for the field theory, again, I really like Classical Field Theory by Landau and Lifshitz. Again, it has everything. So it has gravity, electromagnetism, but more general, how field theory should really look like and what we expect from field theory. So that's discussed in that volume. And then we will use Carol for relativity course, but maybe I'll also use some things from there as well. Zwiebach, your first course in string theory. Of course, we will not discuss any relativistic strings or string theory, but we will discuss the classical string. And it's also discussed there very nicely. So I will take it from there. And so the lecture basically comes from Zwiebach. And finally, let me mention Dirac's book, Lectures on Quantum Mechanics, which basically deals with the constraints. And it's a very small book, again, 100 pages. And it really develops the theory how to deal with constraints, but not only in classical mechanics, but in field theory and when you quantize it. Okay, so this is really a wonderful book. Are there any questions so far? So please don't hesitate to ask questions during my lecture. I will probably not answer them, but I will at least try. All right, so that's the plan. So let's go into that. So part one will be Lagrangian mechanics. And first, we will discuss the Hamilton's principle of least action. So of course, when you start discussing classical mechanics, you can start with Newton's theory, and it's quite powerful, but at the same time, it's quite ugly because you deal with vectors and you deal with things like that. Whereas this, you know, analytical approach to classical mechanics through Lagrangians and Hamiltonians is much more elegant. And of course, that's the way how you go to field theory and how you go further. Okay, so we want to describe the motion of some dynamical system. And this dynamical system is described by some coordinates. And these coordinates need not to be the Cartesian coordinates, but you can choose any coordinates which are convenient for your description of the system. And then, of course, what you are interested in is how these coordinates evolve in time, so really in the dynamics of the system. And so these coordinates, because they are not necessarily Cartesian coordinates, but they are the convenient ones, are called generalized coordinates. And the trick is to choose wisely to eliminate as many constraints as you can. Okay, so for example, if you want to describe a pendulum, okay, so this is what you want to describe, a system. You can describe it in the Cartesian frame. You can have an x coordinate and you can have a z coordinate here. So you could describe it with two coordinates, but you know that actually there's only one true degree of freedom, which is like what is the angle here? So it's much better to actually describe the system when you just choose one generalized coordinate, which will be the angle, instead of having two Cartesian coordinates, x and z. So of course, if you have two Cartesian coordinates, and because your system still has only one degree of freedom, you would have a constraint. So by introducing the angle, I am removing this constraint, and that's really the spirit of Lagrangian mechanics. So you choose these generalized coordinates, and there should be as many as two degrees of freedom. Because if you choose more, there will be constraints, and everything will look much more complicated. So for now, I want to remove all constraints, and then we will return back to constraints later on. Okay, so we are choosing these generalized coordinates, and there's only that many as degrees of freedom. Okay, so then you can think about the dynamical system in two ways. And from Newton's theory, you will typically think about the evolution of these coordinates. So I'll typically suppress this index I, which tells me how many coordinates I have. I will typically do the proofs with just one coordinate, which is simpler and nicer. Okay, so we have these coordinates. And so then you can think about in Newton's theory, typically as an initial value problem, in which case you just start somewhere and you specify what is the value of your coordinate at some time t1. So you specify what q1 is. And then you specify also the velocity, right? And so then you know that you have equations of motion. And these equations of motion from these initial data, they tell you how the system evolves at later time. Okay, so that's the initial value problem formulation. There is another equivalent one, which is like a boundary value formulation. And that is actually a little bit more convenient. So then there is a boundary value. Not really boundary. Value formulation. And that tells you, well, I specify where my system was at time t equal to t1. And then I specify where my system is at later time, t2. Okay? And that, because I have equations of motion as well, that should tell me where the system was in some time in between t1 and t2. Okay? So that the fact that this actually should work, so I specify q1 and I specify q2, but I don't specify necessarily the velocity, so whatever. Okay? And so the fact that this should work, so here I specify two data, the position and the velocity at initial time. Here I specify two data, position at the initial position and the final position. And so in principle, this should be enough to determine the motion. Okay, so this description we will choose. It's the description which is actually in the heart of Hamilton's principle, but it's also basically in the heart of quantum theory. So typically in quantum theory, you ask questions, well, I have stayed here, I have stayed there. What is the transition probability to going from here to there? Right? So usually you deal with the second approach as well in quantum theory. All right, so you'll use the second setup. So now with this, let me formulate this principle of least action. So Hamilton's principle. And it says that the motion of system in time interval t going from t1 to t2 coincides with the extremum of the action functional and so what is the action functional? So typically it's denoted by S. So functional means it's a function of a function. Is that simple. So the action functional is a function of the trajectory of the particle. So of course, the trajectory of the particle is a function of time. And an action is a function of this. So that's why it's functional. Okay, and this is simply given by t1 to t2 integral of some miraculous function L, and you integrate that over time. Okay? So this miraculous function is called Lagrangian. And specifying Lagrangian corresponds to specifying what kind of dynamical system I'm considering. So if you take Lagrangian 1/2 mv square, then you are describing a system of a free particle moving in free space. Okay, so that's the Hamilton's principle. And that's it. So you see that it's enough to specify just one function L to describe the whole motion. So no vectors like in Newtonian theory, no forces, and stuff like that. So just one function L is enough to tell you how the motion will look like. Are there any questions? Okay. So now this is all beautiful, but how do we get the extract? How do we extract the equations of motions? So to extract equations of motion. So we consider precisely the second description. So we consider this boundary value thing. So consider and because Q is fixed at T1 and Q is fixed at T2, this is called fixed endpoints. So consider fixed endpoints formulation. So what it means is that delta Q, okay, so this is this picture again, so T and the Q at T1, we prescribe that we are at Q1, at T2, we prescribe we are at Q2. That means that delta Q, okay, and then we consider the set of trajectories which go from Q1 to Q2. So we can consider all possible trajectories. And the true trajectory will be such that this functional will be extremal. Okay. So true trajectory extremizes the functional S. Okay. So now this is the traditional picture. So of course you have delta Q. So you consider the variations. So at time T, I will have trajectory here. This trajectory has, let's say, Q of T. And there is possible variation where this trajectory has Q of T plus delta Q of T. So this is delta Q of T. And so because we have fixed endpoints, delta Q will vanish at time T1 and will vanish at time T2. So now notice, so we have this delta Q of T are the variations of the trajectory. But if you look at, yes?
In terms of the integrability of the action function, are you making the assumption that Lagrangian is continuous?
Well, we are in physics, so everything is continuous and infinitely differentiable and stuff like that.
Okay.
So of course you can invent some pathological things, and yeah. But here I assume the simplest possible thing. Okay. So delta Q are variations, but it's obvious from the picture is how do I do variation? So I fix time t, I consider one trajectory, qt, and then I just simply move up and consider another trajectory. So time in this kind of variation is fixed. Okay, so let me stress that. So time is fixed in this variation. And simply how I do the variation. So why I'm stressing this is that when we will discuss Noether's theorem at the end of this lecture, it will not be fixed. Okay, so there will be a different kind of variation. So anyway, so in this variation, time is fixed. But what it also means is that when I do the variation in Q, I simply move in this direction. Whereas if I do a motion in time, I move in perpendicular direction. Okay, but these two things have to commute because they are completely independent. So in the variation, I always fix the time. In the time evolution, I fix Q. So what it means is, and you can convince yourself, that actually the variation and so delta and time derivative actually commute. So this is true, and it's simply the way, it's a simple consequence of the way how I define the variation. It's for fixed time. So variation has nothing to do with time. And that's why these two operations commute. All right. So, everybody happy with this? Of course, if you define this mathematically precisely, it's all obvious. Here I'm just doing this intuitive approach. I'm doing variation in Q. I'm doing time evolution, so they should be independent. But it can be mathematically very well defined if you want. All right, so now what we want is to do the variation of the action. And okay, so what is it? So it's delta. The action is integral from T1 to T2 of L dt. Okay, but this variation has nothing to do with time. Well, okay, so first of all, we are in physics, so we can always pull this through the integral. But time is untouched by this variation. So what this is simply an integral from T1 to T2 of delta L dt. I am not varying the time. The time is fixed. Okay? So now variation is basically like a total derivative, so I can use a chain rule. So think about variation as a derivative. It's a functional derivative, but it's like a normal derivative. So then what this is, so L depends on Q and Q dot and T. Okay? So this will be dL over dQ delta Q plus dL over dQ dot delta Q dot. And then plus dL over dt delta t, but I am not varying time, so that's it. All right. So now, of course, what this Q dot is, right? So Q dot is just, so this thing here is delta dQ of t. That's Q dot is dQ over dt, right? So I can swap these two because of the commutativity. So this is the same as d over dt of delta q, right? And then I can use integration by parts to actually move the derivative from delta q to the derivative of this guy. Okay, so integrating by parts, you get an integral t1 to t2. And then you have dL over dQ. If you integrate by parts, you pick up a minus sign, and then you simply move the derivative onto the other term, so from here to there. That's minus d over dt dL over dQ dot, and then delta Q dt. So that's if I integrate by parts, but of course I also pick a boundary term. And so the boundary term from this integration by parts is simply this thing here. So it's dL over dQ dot delta Q at time T2 T1. So this is the boundary term I pick up when I integrate by parts. All right. Is it working? Oh, it's really. Maybe. All right, so we are almost done. So now we want this to be zero, because that's what Hamilton's principle tells us. So we want to extremize the action. So we want this to be zero. But we also know that we are considering this fixed endpoint problem, where actually delta Q at time T1 is zero, because I fix it here. And delta Q at time T2 is zero. So because of fixed endpoints, delta Q at T1 and delta Q at T2 is zero. So this must be zero because we have fixed endpoints. And so then we demand that this integral is equal to zero. But remember, the variation delta Q, as you are doing, is simply, you know, we are considering all possible trajectories here around our trajectory. And we are finding that trajectory by requiring that the action is stationary. So delta Q is arbitrary. Okay, so because delta Q is arbitrary and you want this to be equal to zero, the only possibility is that the integrand is actually equal to zero. Okay, so this has to be equal to zero. The only possibility. And so we arrived at the equations that this must be true. And these are called Euler-Lagrange equations. Uh, Lagrange equations. And so simply, if you have more than one, so I was just using one coordinate, but let me put more than one generalized coordinate. So you would have dl over dqi minus d over dt dl over dqi dot equals to 0. And that's your Euler Lagrange equation. When I was a student, it always bothered me that sometimes people write minus here and sometimes people write minus there. It doesn't matter because it's still equal to 0. So, if you are used to a different convention for this, please. All right, so that's the equations of motion. And of course, if I solve these equations of motion, I extremize the action, and that's what the true motion actually looks like. Questions to this? So then to wake you up, let me just have a few questions for you. So first of all, so some remarks. So if you look at these equations of motion, which order equations are these? Are they first order, zero order, second order, third order in time derivatives?
Second order
because?
You have the u dot and the dE.
So what about L? So L is?
L depends on q dot. Then you take the time derivative.
Exactly. Perfectly. So L depends on q dot. So it's already first order, but now I take another time derivative here. So these are second order differential equations. So Euler Lagrange equations are second order equations of motion. How many initial data or how many data I have prescribed in my procedure?
Two fixed points.
You have prescribed two fixed points, so that means I have two initial data. So can I solve these equations?
Yes.
Of course. So I need two initial data for second order equations. So I have two data, which are the fixed endpoints, and so this should be a well-defined system. So now, interesting thing happens when you add one more derivative to the Lagrangian. So then you would be considering, what is L? You would be considering a theory where L depends on Q, Q dot, and Q double dot. What do you then think the equations of motion will look like? Will they be second order, third order, fourth order, fifth order? Okay, you can start thinking about that. It will be in your tutorial today. And then you will see that there's actually a lot of fun with these higher time derivatives here. Of course, the problem is that if you have higher order than second order in time derivatives of the equation, that you typically have unwanted solutions. Okay, and so typically what happens, for example, is that, well, these solutions are sometimes called runaway solutions. They are the classical analog of ghosts in quantum theory. And so, for example, you can have a particle, if you have third order equation of motion, the particles can be at rest. And even if there is no force, suddenly the particle starts accelerating on its own. It accelerates and, goes away. Okay, so these types of solutions are typically present when you have higher order than second order equations of motion. Now, there is a expert here at PI on how to deal with these unpleasant equations. It's Louis Lehner. So now what the problem is in gravitational theory now is that nobody knows how to extend general relativity, which is second order theory, to something which may capture some features of quantum gravity or whatever. And so people typically consider higher curvature gravities. And so then in the end, you have equations of motion which are higher order than second order in time derivatives. And then you have these unpleasant solutions and stuff like that. So now there's an amazing procedure how from an ill-defined equation of motion, you can actually extract the real physics, how you can upgrade the equation of motion so that it doesn't have these unwanted solutions. So now this is actually an active research area All right, so this is just a trivial remark, but maybe it's quite interesting to consider, you know, what happens when you go beyond just one derivative. Second point, which I will not prove to you, but I will direct you to Landau and Lifshitz, is that, okay, so there's this Lagrangian thing, but maybe from Newtonian mechanics you are used to considering like kinetic energy and potential energy of the system. And then if these are well defined, you can show that the Lagrangian is nothing else than actually the kinetic energy minus the potential energy of the system. Okay, so see Landau and Lifshitz if you are interested how this is actually done. So that's point two. Finally, the most interesting point, I would say, is point that there is a freedom in the description of, in the Lagrangian description. And the statement is that actually, if I have one Lagrangian, and then I have another Lagrangian, which looks like, so I have Q dot of T, this is my new Lagrangian, and it's given by the old one, plus a total derivative of a function which depends only on Q and T, no Q dot here, then this actually describes the same system and the same physics. So gives the same equations of motion. Okay? So there's this freedom in Lagrangian description, and that the freedom is quite powerful and can be used for many things. So how to prove this? So one possibility is that you simply take this new Lagrangian L prime and plug it into your Euler Lagrange equations, do lots of differentiation, and you find that in the end this lambda function actually drops out and it doesn't change your equations of motion. There's a faster way. So we know that our action, so proof. So we know that our action S prime is simply given by L prime dt, which is L plus an integral of L dt plus integral of d lambda dt dt. This is my original action, S. Now I see that my integral looks like S. Sorry for that. Okay, so this is the original action. And of course, this is just a boundary term. So it's lambda evaluated at t2 and t1.
Why is it that it can't depend on Q dot?
Okay, you will see in a minute. Okay, so the statement is it cannot depend on Q dot. If it did, something wrong would happen. You will see what. And you will study it in today's tutorial as well. But I'm just saying at this point, it only can depend on Q. So this is what the new action is. So now if you want to vary this new action, so delta S prime, of course, that's equal to delta S. And now I'll be cheating here, but anyway. So lambda depends on Q only. So I'll just pull the delta through this thing here. And so it's plus d lambda dq. Well, the argument is a little bit wrong, but the result, whatever I'm writing here is correct. D lambda or dq delta q, t2, t1. And there is no q dot thing. So if there was q dot, then you would have another term, d lambda over dq dot, delta q dot, right? T2 and T1. So let's just have it here at this point. But okay. So now, imposing the action principle for the original action, this is zero. Okay. But we have fixed endpoints. And because we have the fixed endpoints, then again, this guy will be zero because of the fixed endpoints. So this thing will be zero because of the fixed endpoints. But this guy here has delta Q dot, right? And so there is no way you could actually prescribe that delta Q dot is also zero. Well, so that's why lambda cannot depend on Q dot. Okay, so this term cannot be there. Cannot be there, because if it were there, it wouldn't be zero. And then, of course, it would change the extremum. So, but if the term is not there, we have zero plus zero, which is zero. So you see that if the original action is stationary, the new action will be also stationary. And so that's why the equations of motion cannot change. So really, lambda can depend only on Q, but it cannot depend on Q dot. Questions? Very good. Yes?
How do you go from the delta to the derivative?
Sorry? How do you go from delta to here?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you want, we can do it at this level, right? So this is maybe cleaner. So I do delta S prime here, and I do delta S here, so that's fine. But then I put a delta here.
Okay.
I can pull the delta into the integral.
Yeah.
And then I have delta d lambda over dt, but I can swap delta and d over dt because they commute. So I'll have d over dt delta lambda. But delta lambda is d lambda over dq delta q. But if you want to do it at this level.
Okay.
That would be, so what I'm writing here is correct,
but
it doesn't look correct, okay? Yeah. Any other question? All right, so we have equations of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equations. So now let's try to solve them. Okay, so part B, integrals of motion. So unfortunately, from undergraduate physics, you always encounter only the cases where actually you can solve the equations of motion analytically, but that can only be done for integrable systems. And integrable systems actually form measure zero subset of all systems. So it's basically very, very special situation, which never happens. Well, except it does, because we have the Kepler problem. So to solve equations of motion, we can do it analytically. For example, you can solve really harmonic oscillator. You can find what Q is for harmonic oscillator or for what it is for the pendulum and so on. But this is only possible if we have integrable system. And these integrable systems are super rare, as I said, measure zero. So basically, if you have integrable system and then you just perturb it a little bit, it won't be integrable anymore, right? So these are very rare, but at the same time, they are quite important. And so one example of an integrable system is Kepler problem. And so that's certainly important example, okay? So we can do it analytically. So now suppose that your system is not integrable, but it only differs from the integrable one slightly. Okay, so I almost have spherically symmetric potential, but then I perturb it a little bit by presence of another planet or whatever. So then you can do a perturbation theory around the integrable systems or around the, so then perturbations. Perturbations about integrable systems around integrable systems. So who has done some perturbation theory? Maybe in quantum mechanics or? Oh, everybody, perfect. So I just wanted to warn you that I'm not going to discuss perturbations in this course at all. Okay, so but we have done that, so we don't need to. But anyway, this is extremely useful. So you have an integrable system. It's not a realistic system. You need to change it a little bit, but you can perturb it in some small parameter, and then study the perturbations around this integrable system, and you can still find some kind of corrections to your integrable system. Okay. So finally, of course, you can do it fully numerically. And I am also not going to discuss that. Okay, so what I'm basically interested in, what are the conditions so that you can really integrate your system? So what are your conditions here? And the statement is that in order to solve your equations of motion analytically, you need to have special properties of the system, and in particular, you need to have so-called integrals of motion. So to solve analytically, integrals of motion have to be present. All right, so what is an integral of motion? Anybody can tell me?
A conserved quantity.
Uh-huh, it's a conserved quantity, so what does it mean? It's a conserved quantity.
That it's constant during the motion.
Exactly, perfect. So definition. An integral or a constant of motion, an integral or constant of motion is a function, let's call it integral I, it's a function of q dot, possibly time, not really. So typically a function of q and q dot. That would have to be a miracle that it's also function, explicit function of time. But anyway, such that its value is preserved along the time evolution. So di over dt equals to zero. So the value of the thing. So for example, if you have conserved energy, right, so the particle carries some energy. So if I look at the particle here, it has some energy, then it goes wherever it needs to go. And then I measure the energy of the particle again, and it's the same value of the energy. So this is di over dt for a solution of equation of motion. Okay, so as long as the equations of motion are satisfied, this thing will not change its value. Okay. So now, of course, you know where I'm heading. So it's this beautiful work by Emmy Noether, who basically connected the existence of these integrals of motion with some geometric properties of the system. And so in the notes, I actually gave you a link or whatever to a recent preprint of Noether's paper, so you can look at that beautiful paper. And what is really interesting about this theorem is that people are still working on this and still, you know, try to generalize it. And so you see lots of research papers trying to generalize Noether's theorem to various situations. But if you look up the original paper, it is the most general one. And so all these generalizations are actually subcases of the original paper by Emmy Noether. Okay, so that's interesting fact. Okay, so let me formulate the version one. So Noether theorem. You'll see several versions in this course. But as I said, the original one is much more general than anything else. So version one, let's formulate very vague. So for every global continuous symmetry, that's something strange here, symmetry, for every continuous symmetry of the system, uh, there is a corresponding integral of motion. So this is good. So if I find a global continuous symmetry, I know I will have the corresponding integral of motion. Then we shall see later on that if we have enough integrals of motion, then we can actually integrate the motion completely. Okay. But of course, you are talking about the symmetry here. So you are talking about geometric property of the system. So for example, I rotate the system and the system remains the same. So it's a certain geometric property. So it really connects geometry with physics, right? So geometrizes physics. And so that's very, very deep statement. All right, so I haven't told you what I mean by continuous global symmetry. So I'll have to tell you that. So I need to introduce some terminology in order to understand this statement a little bit better. So some terminology. So first, let me start with simple terms, which are not actually in formulation of this theorem. And that the statement is valid off-shell or on-shell. OK? So what do you think on-shell means?
Satisfy the equals to mc squared plus.
Aha, very good. So it satisfies something. Very good.
The equations of motion.
So for classical mechanics, we would say it satisfies the equations of motion. So if you talk about, you know, field theory or whatever, you would say that something is on-shell when really the mass condition is satisfied, m squared equals to k squared or something like that. But more generally, what it means is that, you know, some kind of equation is satisfied. Okay, so on-shell, so first on-shell means equations of motion are satisfied. Whereas off-shell would mean that irrespective of the equations of motion. Off-shell means irrespective . So typically you hear this statement is true off-shell, means I don't need to use equations of motion to show that. It's simply true whether the equations of motion are true or not. But on-shell, it means I need the equations of motion to show that. OK, so that's first terminology. Second terminology is really the classification of the constraints. Of the symmetries. So types of symmetries. And I'm sure that you know what global and continuous means, but let me just repeat that. And so let me be very concrete. So let us consider a transformation where I can change time and I can change generalized coordinates. Okay? So in this transformation, I go from t to nu time t prime, which is t plus some variation of t. And look at that my delta now has tilde in it. So that means a different, completely different delta. Okay? So this delta has fixed time. Remember, so when we are doing the derivation of equations of motion, time was fixed. And so delta here has nothing to do with time. It's just you fix time, and then you do variation in q direction. But of course, here I'm changing time. So it's a different delta. Okay, but at the same time, I can change the coordinates to q goes to q prime. So now in the new time, t prime, and it will be q of t plus delta tilde q of t. Okay? So again, I have delta tilde because now I'm changing time here. So the original delta would be q prime of t is q of t plus delta q of t, right? So the time t would be the same here and there. So that would be the original definition of delta. But if you have delta tilde, this time is different from these times here, okay? Because I'm changing the time as well. Okay, so now what does it mean? So let me draw a picture. So I think it's really understanding Noether's theorem is about understanding the difference between delta and delta tilde, at least in the way I am formulating it. So let me stress again. So if we have the equation of motion set up, we do the variation delta, which means we consider this setup. So we have, this is the delta of q. So time is fixed here. Time is fixed. Okay, but also when we do the equations of motion, we use these fixed endpoints, right? So we fixed the variation at the boundary at t1 and t2. So we had fixed endpoints. So now in Noether setup, this is very, very different. So now Noether. We have variation delta tilde. And we are allowed to vary time as well. Okay, so what it means is that I start with some trajectory here. I choose whatever q at some time t. So this would be q of t. And then I consider a different trajectory, you know, q prime at t prime, but t prime is different from t. So it's some, so let's say later time, t prime. Okay, so that will be a delta tilde t here. And then I can change q as well, right? So I'm moving from q of t to q prime at t prime. And so I'm moving it from, but not only in this direction, but also in that direction, okay? And of course, I have to do that because, for example, I consider a symmetry of the system, which is the time translation. Okay, so if I, so all I do is that I just consider the same system, but now in later time. So I'm shifting everything only in time. Of course, in that case, I would move from here in this direction to there. Okay, so that would be my motion. If I consider just the space, translation or whatever, then I will move him this way. But in general, I'm moving in both ways. Okay, so that's what it is. So now, what basically is doing is that it's shifting this trajectory to some new trajectory here. Okay, but I'm shifting in both directions. If you consider time translation or space translation, can you have fixed endpoints? For example, I move the system in space. So I move it from this trajectory upwards here. I move it everywhere, right? So I'm moving the whole system. So that means I cannot have fixed endpoints because also my endpoints are moving, right? Also, this will go here, this will go here, and so on. So I cannot have fixed endpoints in general. So in this type of variation or in this type of setup, there are no fixed endpoints because I would simply forbid some kind of transformation for the system. But because I don't have fixed endpoints, I used the fixed endpoints condition in order to integrate by parts and throw away the boundary term. Okay? But now I don't have fixed endpoints, so I cannot throw away the boundary term. Okay? And the boundary term is precisely what gives you the integral of motion. So cannot throw away boundary terms. When integrating by parts. Okay. And so, yes.
And also, we passed the delta through the integral, right? But now the endpoints of the integral, not the motion, are also changing, right?
Exactly. So, in principle, they can be also changing. That's right. Yeah.
And the integral is now over t1 prime to t2 prime, right?
Yeah, you would have to change according to t1 and t2, which is not how I am going to do. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, I'll have to think about that.
There's always in these discussions this formula of the infinite decimal variation of dt. Well, mm-hmm. More common in field theory, the infinite decimal variation of d4x. Is the Jacobian, right?
That's right.
Yes, that's what takes care of that.
I probably, yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right, so there are three differences. Just one difference is that we put tilde above delta, so that's one difference. Second difference is that actually we change time as well, right? But because we change time, we cannot, we change time as well. It's another difference. We cannot have fixed endpoints because we would forbid some nice symmetries of the system. But because we cannot have fixed endpoints, we cannot integrate by parts, or actually we can, but we have to keep the boundary terms. So just have that in mind. So now let me write some stupid thing. So we have this delta tilde t and delta tilde q. Let me just write it in this way, which is the most stupid way you can imagine. But anyway, I use this notation because I don't know anything better. So I'll just write it in this way. And what I mean by that is that I want to split my variation into a parameter which tells me how big the variation is. Okay, how big variation is. And then, roughly speaking, a generator which tells me what kind of variation I am doing. So basically, what I mean by this is, let's say you consider rotations, so then the delta q will tell you, really, I am doing rotation in the phi direction or whatever. I'm not doing a translation, but I'm doing a rotation. And then epsilon tells me how big the rotation is. Okay, do I rotate 1 degree or 2 degrees or 3 degrees or whatever? Okay, so let's split it into, you know, what kind of transformation I'm doing and how much that transformation is actually. All right, so then once we have this stupid notation, we can distinguish various types of symmetries. So first of all, we can have discrete symmetries, or we can have continuous ones. It's probably spelled like that. Continuous symmetries. So of course, discrete symmetries, for example, you have a lattice, and you have atoms in the lattice or whatever. So this is my system. And now I want to translate the system so that it looks exactly the same. So that means that the epsilon parameter, so I'm doing the translation, I'm moving every atom into another one, but the translation has to be by exactly the lattice spacing A. Okay, so that's an example of a discrete symmetry because, okay, so I have to have a finite, more generally, I have to have finite possible, well, whatever, parameter. Okay, so that's an example of a discrete symmetry. Or also, you know, there's another stupid example. I have a square, and I want to rotate that square into itself. But in order to rotate the square into itself, I have to rotate it by 90 degrees. Otherwise, I will get a different picture. So that's another example of a discrete symmetry. OK, so discrete symmetries are characterized by finite parameter epsilon. On the other hand, continuous symmetries, the parameter can be arbitrarily small. Parameter arbitrarily small. And an example, again, stupid example, I have a circle. Now I want to rotate that. But of course, in order this to look exactly the same, I can make epsilon arbitrarily small. OK, so that would be an example of a continuous symmetry. We have discrete and continuous. So now we know what Noether means by continuous symmetry. It means epsilon is arbitrarily small. By the way, there are, as far as I know, there is not really any conservation associated with these discrete symmetries. Of course, in condensed matter physics, you have something like Bloch's theorem and stuff like that, but it's not really any conserved charges or whatever. Okay. So the symmetries are only associated with these continuous symmetries. Integrals of motion only associated with continuous symmetries.
What about spin, for instance?
What about?
If you are conserving spin, then wouldn't that be a discrete symmetry?
Well, it depends on what kind of spin system you are considering. So typically, if you consider Ising model or whatever, then you have Z2 symmetry. You are either up or down, in which case it's a discrete symmetry. If you consider a continuous symmetry where the spin can go all the way like that, you have continuous symmetry. These are fundamentally different, and that's why the behavior of these systems is very different.
And is it possible when we have like discrete symmetries?
Yes.
When we have discrete symmetries, is it possible to add something to make it continuous? Like if it's invariant per time reversal.
Okay.
Is it possible to define like a complex time and do it continuously from t to minus t and say, okay, I define an imaginary time, and so I can use Noether in this with this time, and then I continuously go from t to minus t.
I have no idea. It sounds interesting. I don't know. So have you seen that like done somewhere or?
Yeah.
No, but you know, with the lattice is obvious, right? So I really have to move by A unless I send A to zero, which is not the real case. I don't have continuous symmetry, and then you don't have any integral of motion like conserved momentum or whatever. But you know, because it's periodic and so on, then you still have some nice properties, but it's not really a conservation.
Is there any sort of weaker version of Noether theorem for discrete symmetries?
I don't think so. Like, there is no corresponding integral of motion. There's still some nice properties, but not integral of motion. All right, so the second classification is about the global and the local ones. So the global one simply means that the parameter which you consider in the symmetry is a constant. That means I rotate the system. OK, so epsilon is constant. The local one, in case of the mechanics, would be that epsilon actually can be a function of time. OK, so that's the local one. So in other words, I can actually change how much I rotate depending on, you know, time. I can rotate it in one time this way and then in another time that way, whatever. And so if you have a symmetry, it really matters whether this is constant or whether that actually can be a function of your time. So the Noether's theorem, which we are formulating here, deals with the global symmetries. So really, your system has to be symmetric under a transformation when epsilon is constant. Okay, so that's the first Noether's theorem. And that's the one which we discuss here. And that's the one which gives you the integrals of motion. Okay, so now the local or gate symmetry. Gate symmetry is also interesting. And it's subject to the second Noether's theorem, also published in the same paper. And that actually does not give you really integrals of motion, which, so integrals of motion, they are conserved on shell. So if the equations of motion are satisfied, we know that the energy is conserved. Second Noether's theorem gives you instead, it doesn't give you integrals of motion, but it gives you so-called Bianchi identities. Which are, if you want, constraints on equations of motion. Oh, constraints. And these constraints are satisfied off shell. So no matter the equations of motion. So basically, out of the second Noether's theorem, you get some extra equations which you can use. And these equations will be valid for any kind of motion. Okay? So that being said, I don't want to discuss second Noether's theorem at all here, but you will see it later on. Okay? Yes?
When they go local and global, I don't see the relationship between the definition and geometry. Like, why something that is like has a parameter in time, why it is local? I don't see it.
So, you know, so these are different kinds of things, right? So, for example, when you are showing that the thing is a symmetry, right, it really matters whether, for example, in order to show that it's a symmetry, I can maybe integrate by parts, something like that, or whatever. So if I'm taking derivative of this one, it vanishes. If I'm taking derivative of that one, it does not vanish, or whatever, right? So these are like fundamentally different symmetries.
But like in geometry, where they're global, why when you're having something constant, then it's global, like geometric. I mean, like when I hear like global, I feel something like the geometry of like the entire manifold or something.
Exactly. Well, so okay. So if you are talking about the space-time or whatever in the context of field theory, then your epsilon would depend on all spatial and time coordinates. So for example, the rotation. So as I move in the space, I could rotate differently here, differently there, differently here, whatever. So that would be the local rotational symmetry. Whereas the global rotational symmetry means I rotate everywhere the same way. Okay. But you will see examples, don't worry. Other questions? So the Noether theorem I am formulating here deals with the global symmetries and with the continuous ones. Okay, so now with this equipped, I can formulate a version 2. So this one is very nice. It tells me once I have global continuous symmetry, I have a conserved quantity. But let's actually find this conserved quantity. And so Noether version 2, and I would say the ugly but explicit version. So I'll be considering precisely this type of transformation here, I'm writing here. And so the statement is let delta tilde be, let the transformation given here, so let's call it delta tilde. So let this transformation delta tilde be a global continuous symmetry of the system. That means, okay, that is off shell So not using the equations of, well, this is very important, off-shell equations of motion are not used when I'm showing that this is a symmetry. We find delta tilde t and delta tilde q so that delta tilde s equals to zero. So I find such a transformation, delta tilde, so that my action does not change off shell. I'm not using equations of motion here. So then you say you have a symmetry. If you find such delta tilde t, delta tilde q, so that this is true, you say this is a symmetry. Okay, so then statement is you have a prescription for the integral of motion, which is dl over dq dot delta tilde q plus L minus q dot dl over dq dot delta tilde t is an integral of motion that means that it is conserved on shell. Okay, so that's
L minus q dot?
Yes, please. So it's L, so this is L, minus q dot dl over dq dot delta tilde t. Okay, so really, if you can find such a transformation which leaves the action invariant, then the statement is this will be your conserved quantity. Now this one does not work. All right, so yes?
Can we say the other way that if we find a lot of quantities that are conserved, we can say that this is a symmetry of the system or not?
This is a good question. So people writing papers about having integrals of motion without a symmetry, I am not sure and not convinced that they are actually correct. So I would say they are, I would probably say they are one-to-one, but if you have a symmetry of an integral of motion and the other way around, but I'm not sure. So people question that.
Now there's an original paper says that there's a converse.
So you see, that's what I would say. But definitely, you know, recent papers say, well, I can have integrals of motion even without symmetry. But I'm not convinced.
So, like, is this equation just saying that despite not having any fixed endpoints, you can still kind of have a modified version of the integral? Like, is that a right way of putting it?
I'm not sure. So, say it again.
Like, because like we said that we need to have fixed endpoints so that we can have an integral of motion. But what we are doing now is that we are still defining an integral of motion despite having some kind of variation in q and t.
No. Sorry. So you have an integral of motion if you have simply a quantity which is conserved in time. So as you move along the trajectory, this quantity is actually conserved. It has the same value of energy, same value of angular momentum or whatever. So that's what an integral of motion is, right? And so, of course, the integral of motion is, you know, makes sense only for that motion. So the motion has to satisfy equations of motion. It has to be the real motion, right? So talking about integrals of motion means only anything when you are on shell, when the equations of motion are satisfied. So the statement here is that in order to find the symmetry, actually, I cannot use the equations of motion. Either the symmetry is there in the system without using the equations of motion or not. Okay, so when I'm trying to find the symmetry, I cannot use the equations of motion because equations of motion have nothing to do with whether the symmetry is present in the system or not. Once I find that symmetry, then this is the prescription for the integral of motion, and the integral of motion will be conserved quantity along the motion when the equations are satisfied. So it's. All right, so let me have two examples. So one of them is the time translation symmetry that's the nice one. Line translation. Symmetry. So what it means is that, well, typically the Lagrangian is not a function of time explicitly. So of course, time enters Q, through Q and Q dot, but not explicitly of time. Okay, and so then you can show that if you take transformation delta, which is somewhere hidden here, and you take delta tilde t to be epsilon, so I'm translating in time, but I'm not doing anything with the coordinates, I'm only translating everything in time. So I'm moving just in this direction, just translating everything in here, okay? So this is the transformation. Then you can show that this actually leaves the action invariant, provided that L is no function of time. So what did I write here? Delta then delta tilde s equals to 0, provided L is not a function of time. You can check that if you want. So please check. You will sort of do it in the tutorial today. Please check. Okay, but then I have this prescription for the integral of motion. So you see, okay, so delta tilde q is 0. So this term is not here. And delta tilde t is epsilon, and that's conserved. But epsilon is constant, right? So I can throw it away, and that means that this actually is an integral of motion. So then I is simply this part here, L minus q dot dl dq dot. Let me put I's here so that we can touch on something very interesting. And so this is an integral of motion, and it will be called generalized energy. Okay, so if L does not depend on time, then you can show that this would be the symmetry of the action, and the corresponding integral of motion is this one here, and it's called generalized energy. So why is this interesting? So I put I and I. Of course, if you see the two same indices, you sum over them. So if you have more generalized coordinates, q1, q2, q3, then this will be L minus q1 dot dl over dq1 plus or minus q2 dot dl over dq2 and q3 as well. Okay, so we are using Einstein summation convention. And when people ask how to financially evaluate Einstein's contribution to the world, they came up that this is actually the biggest thing he invented, because it saves lots of ink and lots of paper, that financially this is really, really something. So if he had it as a patent, then he would be rich. All right, so that's the generalized energy. So once we have this prescription, it's simple to show that this is actually conserved. Okay, I'll just show that in a minute. The problem is to find this prescription, right? And so it's given to you in this theorem version 2, and I don't know if I'll have time to derive it. So let's see. Okay, anyway. So the proof is very simple. So you want to show that this is conserved on shell, right? So we want to show that dI over dt is equal to 0, provided the equations of motion are satisfied.
I'm sorry, we're proving the example or the?
Yeah, this example here. Just this example at this point. Okay, so then what is this? So we have dl over dt. Okay, so L depends on q and q dot, so it's dl over dq, q dot, plus dl over dq dot, q double dot, plus dl over dt in principle can be, but it is not because of this. So this term is not here. So that's the first term, and then we have minus d over dt of q dot dl over dq dot. Okay, so this is just dl. And t dl over dt. And then that's the term there. Okay, so what do we have? Okay, let's work on this. So we can use the, what is it? Leibniz rule. We have Q double dot dl over dq dot. And there's a minus sign, so let's put it here. And I mean, you differentiate the other one, so it's minus q dot dl. Okay, so what's happening? Okay, so we maybe don't need to do that. So it's minus q dot d over dt dl over dq dot. All right. So now if you look at these expressions, so this one is not here because of the property of the Lagrangian. Now dl over dq dot q double dot is canceled by this term here. So this one eats this one. Okay. And then you have dl over dq minus d over dt dl over dq dot q dot. And you see that in the bracket is precisely Euler-Lagrange equation. And so one shell, this is valid, so this is equal to zero. Okay? So once you have the prescription for I, it's actually super simple to show that this is an integral of motion. The key point is, how do you actually come up with the prescription for I? Okay? Okay, second example. Are there any questions to this? Second example is even simpler. So you have space translation symmetry or whatever. Not really. So what I mean by that is that I can actually move my generalized coordinates. I can do q plus epsilon and nothing changes. But what it actually means is that L cannot depend on my q. Okay, so let's say there is some one q which the Lagrangian is not function of. Let's say the Lagrangian is not function of the angle phi, okay? Or it's not function of x coordinate. So then you would call this coordinate, which is missing in the Lagrangian, a cyclic coordinate. Cyclic coordinate. So what it means is that in this case, we are not doing anything with time. Delta t is equal to zero, but we are shifting the corresponding qc by epsilon. And you know, nothing changes. And so then, in this case, I can use this prescription again. So delta tilde t is zero, so this part is gone. And then I have that dl over dq dot is conserved. So then e I delta dl over dq dot c is conserved. And that's my integral of motion. And to see this one is even simpler than that, than the previous thing. So again, the proof is just you look at the Euler-Lagrange equations, right? And you see that L is not a function of qc. So this term is gone. And so then you have d over dt, dl over dq is equal to zero, which means dl over dq dot has to be equal to constant. Okay, so this is Euler-Lagrange equation. Of course, this is called generalized momentum. Generalized. Why generalized? If I consider the generalized coordinates to be x coordinate, it will really be momentum in the x direction, px. If I consider an angle, phi, it will be angular momentum, not just a standard momentum. All right. So I have 5 minutes.
So in the translational symmetry one, you were just proving that I worked, or?
Sorry, I was.
What is the?
Sorry.
That you were doing.
So I was just maybe too fast. So I'm saying this is the transformation you are doing, and then I'm reading off what the integral of motion is from this formula.
Okay.
Right. So this thing is gone. that is just epsilon. So then this thing has to be conserved. So dl over dq dot. Okay. So now once I find this integral of motion, I want to again show that this is conserved. Right? So what I want to show is that d of I, so d over dt of this thing, dl over dq dot c is equal to zero. That's what you want to show. But I can actually show it by doing this thing here. So now I'll use the other convention, qc. Right? This is still true because L does not depend on qc. Okay? But this is the Euler-Lagrange equation, which has to be zero. So that's the proof. All right. Okay. So now I know that everybody is dying to see how this is shown. So I'll take maybe extra 8 minutes or whatever to show this. So very good. So proof of Noether theorem version 2. And so to prove that, basically one needs to understand how really delta tilde q relates to delta q. So this would be delta q. I keep the time fixed. So this is the delta q. But now I have the real delta tilde q when I can change time as well. So what is the relation between delta tilde q and delta tilde t, and delta and delta tilde? And you can see it from the picture here. So you see that delta tilde is delta plus something. And what that something is a derivative times delta tilde t. OK, so you see from the picture is delta tilde q is delta q. So delta tilde q is delta q plus this piece. But what is this piece? There is a derivative here. So it's dq over dt plus dq over dt times time. So that's how I get this thing here. And the time is delta tilde t. OK. So just from the picture, you can see this is true. And then, of course, you know, this is only true if delta tilde t is small. But yeah. OK. So the linear order in perturbations. OK. So more generally.
So why the derivative is not the dq prime over dt prime, just dq over dt?
Sorry, here?
Yeah.
It could be. But the difference is of high order.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. It could be. I could write it, but then I'll have something which is of high order. I'm just going to the first order. Okay, so more generally, this will actually be true for any function of q and q dot. So take any function of q, q dot, and t, and then this you can prove this relation as well. So you have an operational relation that delta tilde is delta plus delta tilde t times d over dt. And you can put any function there. So I proved it for function q, but this will be true for any function of q and q dot and t. Okay, so that's good. And the time is up, so I will take All right, so now let us calculate what this delta tilde s is. So by assumption, this has to be zero. That's my assumption of a symmetry, okay? So this delta tilde s has to be equal to zero. So now what is it equal to? And that was the question some time ago. So now I have to vary both. I have to vary time, which means the measure of the integration, but also the Lagrangian. So there'll be two terms. So it's delta tilde of L dt plus L delta tilde of dt. I'm changing both. I'm changing the time and I'm changing the Lagrangian. Okay. Very good. So now L is some function of q, q dot nt. So I can apply this wonderful operational identity here. Okay. So then I have an integral over. So now this will be delta L plus delta tilde t and then dl over dt and then plus L. This thing here. So now, delta tilde of d of t. Okay, so what is it? It's dt prime minus dt. Delta tilde dt, dt prime minus dt, which is d of delta t, if you want. In this case, they actually do commute on t, but they don't commute in general. Okay, and then I can divide it by dt, and I can multiply by t dt, and that's still true. Okay, so now this thing, I will just use that. So it's L d delta tilde t dt times dt. All right, so now if you look at these two terms here, then maybe something is wrong here. I'm missing dt here everywhere. Okay, let's put it here. Okay, that's not good. Dt, 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 like that. Everybody happy? Okay, so now if I look at these two terms, what it should give me is just d over dt of L delta tilde t dt. Okay, so my variation is simply a delta L plus d over dt L delta tilde t dt. So I have some variation, standard variation of L, and then I have some boundary term here. Okay? If I were doing the derivation of equations of motion, this thing wouldn't be there, and I just have this thing here. All right, so the last step is actually to do what you do when you're deriving equations of motion, really do this variation of L, but not throw away the boundary term, because now we don't have fixed endpoints. So we have to pick up that boundary term. Okay. So when you are doing this, it's precisely what you were doing for the equations of motion, but don't throw away the boundary term. Keep it and just put it to this boundary term here. Okay, so you can do it yourself, and what you find is that the boundary terms now says, of course, this one here. That's L delta tilde t plus the one which you get from the equations of motion. DL over dq dot delta q. Okay, so this is what we thrown away when we were integrating by parts, when we are deriving the equations of motion. And then you have the standard terms which come from the Euler-Lagrange equation, right? Plus the Euler-Lagrange term, which comes from varying L, as before. Okay, so now, when the equations of motion are satisfied, the Euler-Lagrange term vanishes because it's okay. So this will go to zero on the shell. And so we have zero equals to this thing here. All right. But these are just the boundary terms. So this is value of this at time t1 and minus at time t2. But because it's equal to zero, they have to be equal. So whatever this thing here is at time t1, it must be the integral of motion. It's preserved. Because at time t1, it's the same as time t2. But of course, t1 and t2 are arbitrary here. So this is really the Kontsev integral. So this guy is the Kontsev integral. OK, and so now I am writing it this way. So I'm saying this is the Kontsev integral. But I gave you this formula here. The statement is they are the same. And so what the only difference is that, look, we have delta tilde t here. That's fine. That's precisely the variation we want. But here we have delta q, not delta tilde q. So the only thing is that you have to use that formula again between delta tilde and delta and plug this guy in terms of delta tilde q instead of delta q. And then you arrive at this integral here. OK, so this was very fast and frustrating. So I'll give you an opportunity to go through this proof again in your tutorial today. And let me stop here.